education system. We just heard a bill this last week on the subject matter in terms of providing funding. And we have today to give us the information that we are craving, Brian Johnston and the Honorable Sue Leeson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have you today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, Senator Whitsitt. My name is Brian Johnston, and along with the Honorable Susan Leeson, we're going to take about 50 minutes of your time, and then we'll answer any questions that you might have. I want to introduce my compatriot to you first, and then let her begin. Susan Leeson taught political science at Willamette University for 22 years, and during that period of time, she was not sufficiently occupied, so she earned her law degree, and she, when she graduated from Willamette Law, shortly thereafter, she was appointed by Governor Roberts to the Court of Appeals. She served 5 years on the Court of Appeals, 5 years on the Oregon Supreme Court. She stepped down, a year and a half ago?
2 years.
2 years ago, and is now engaged in two projects. One is a national youth legal project, and one is a project that also takes her across the nation, where she's teaching the law of search and seizure to police officers. And she's going to give you an overview, the big picture. I'm going to talk about the processes themselves, and then we're going to try and tie those processes back into the state of Oregon. Then we'll answer any questions you have, and we'll make sure that Willamette mails your law degrees to you.
Thank you. I could use one of those many times in this committee. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Senators. I really appreciate being here. Did you get handouts, by the way, that we asked to have reproduced for you?
Let's see. No, I don't think we...
That would be really wonderful to have, because I'm going to be referring to some visuals.
Did you give them to Mr. Taylor?
Yes. And
I'll go check.
That'd be great. Thank
handouts
you.
Handouts are on the way, and if you could identify yourself for the record, even though we all know you.
My name is Susan Leeson. My task today is to do an overview, courts in context, the big picture. Brian and I have timed our presentation, we're told, to be about the same amount of time it takes to have a root canal. We're going to try to make this a little more pleasant than that. State courts are called courts of general jurisdiction, so they're presumed to have the power to resolve disputes that arise. This is where it would be nice to have the handout material, because I'm going to be contrasting them with federal courts, and when those pictures arrive, maybe we'll just double back and talk about it. So people are... Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll do our best. Thanks so much. The assumption is that if Oregonians have a legal problem, they can go into their state courts for a resolution. There are also federal courts, and as I was talking to some of the young people who are here today, they just assumed that federal courts were the most important. Yeah, we know better than that. We're Oregonians. Federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. You have to plead the right to be in state court, either by the United States Constitution or by a federal statute. So these two court systems are working in tandem with one another, but they both serve very different kinds of people's needs. The data that I will be referring to today is from 2003, and Kingsley Quick will be happy to provide you with this information if you need more overwhelming statistics. But I wanted to have the numbers from 2003 to just give you kind of a snapshot of what the judicial system looks like in Oregon. In 2003, almost 656,000 cases were filed in Oregon courts. That's a pretty staggering number, given a population of about 3.5 million. And, of course, in most litigation, there's more than one party involved. So what that number tells us is that a lot of Oregonians become involved with the judicial system. Now, of that about 656,000 cases, 433 of those were felonies, misdemeanors, infractions, violations, or extraditions from other jurisdiction. And, of course, the biggest number of those were traffic infractions, when you get a parking ticket for speeding, for example, it's a summons to court. And so that number isn't quite as overwhelming. At least the mind doesn't immediately say, gee, we have this huge crime problem in Oregon. But we have speeders. Those are our biggest number of people who are being called into criminal courts. The second largest category of cases that were filed in Oregon courts, about 77,000 of them were civil cases. That includes a range of cases from, as I say, A to Z, accounting and receivership to zoning. I have a huge range of civil cases. The next biggest number is small claims, about 59,000 cases in small claims courts, about 50,000 domestic relations cases, about 18,000 juvenile cases, 10,000 probate, and 8,200 mental health. So the courts are going to be involved in our lives literally from birth to death. One of the sheets that I handed out, a colored picture of Oregon carved up by judicial districts, shows how we have decided to organize the courts in this state. Usually these trial courts, well, they're obviously, they're geographically oriented. Usually they cover one county, but you'll notice that some of the courts do not cover just one county. I think what's nice about this pictorial representation is a couple of things. It shows us that in some judicial districts, the judges and staff are dealing with huge geographical areas, relatively small population. Other courts in the urban areas are dealing with very large populations covering relatively small geographic area. They also, as you well know, confront very different kinds of issues. We don't have a lot of litigation on this side of the mountain until this year over water, but of course in eastern Oregon that's a major subject of litigation. So the work that judges do depends on where they're sitting, the phrase we use when we're working. A lot of people do stand to do the work, but that's okay. What they do depends on the area of the state in which they sit and the population that they're serving. Oregon, like every other state in the union, has a system of trial courts, courts of appeal, and a Supreme Court. And that's reflected on this second piece of paper that I handed out. And this shows us a number of things. In Oregon, we don't merely have courts of general jurisdiction, but we also have some very specialized county courts, justice courts, municipal courts in different parts of the state, but not everywhere. And so you'll talk to judges who will say that they just heard a case that came out of their justice court. And some other judge will look at them and say, wait a minute, we don't have those in my county. So there's great diversity here. Those cases, in terms of the right of appeal, filter to the Oregon Court of Appeals, and then to the Oregon Supreme Court. And you'll notice a line going from the tax court to the Supreme Court. The Oregon Court of Appeals does not hear tax cases. Moreover, the Oregon Supreme Court has direct review of a number of cases, such as ballot title challenges and death penalty. So this chart is helpful, I think, in telling us the number of people it takes to do the job and the structure of that system. Now, if that's not complicated enough, there is an overlay of federal courts, and the federal system adds a wrinkle of complication to the work that the state courts do that is huge. I don't know if they were able to get reproduced this picture of the United States, but we'll get it to you eventually. And what it shows is, first, that the federal courts have trial courts in every state. So last night I was on a panel with Ann Aiken, who's a federal district court judge in Eugene. Appeals from the district courts go to geographic courts of appeal. Sadly, Oregon lives in the ugliest color. But we can change that by just going to another chart somewhere. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is geographically huge.
Thank you. I'm coming around.
And as you notice, the Ninth Circuit...
Logistical problems here.
Now that always happens, doesn't it?
Especially when you're talking about the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah. As Brian says, especially when you're talking about the Ninth Circuit.
That is huge.
It's huge. And notice that it takes up Alaska and Hawaii as well. So geographically, it's by far the biggest court in the country. Some people think that the fact that it's... has such a huge caseload in geography makes it even more significant than the United States Supreme Court. So one of the things you may hear during the session is the ongoing debate to split the Ninth Circuit. Nobody's figured out a way to do it yet that makes sense, but the game is afoot. Now, there are two kind of specialized courts, one for the District of Columbia and the other for the Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit was created in about 1992 because one of the realities of these courts of appeals is that they disagree with each other about the meaning of the law, leading to what the U.S. Supreme Court calls inter-circuit conflicts. They think inter-circuit conflicts are just swell. It lets the law evolve. It gets a lot of judicial minds involved in thinking about how to solve a problem. But Congress decided there were some areas where conflict in the law was not a good idea. So, patent, copyright, Veterans Affairs, Merit System Protection Board, all appeals from all over the country go to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. It happens to be housed in Washington, D.C. An immense judicial system that works in tandem with the Oregon Supreme Court. Now, sometimes laws that we pass in Oregon affect federal jurisdiction. Sometimes the opposite happens. And let me give you an example of the opposite. There's a federal statute called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. The acronym is RLUIPA, and I understand I get fined now if I use acronyms.
Not here.
Not here.
We observe Article 1, Section 8 here.
Thank you. I can speak freely even on any subject of acronyms. This is good. Well, this Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act has run right head-on into Oregon land use laws, zoning laws. So the Oregon Supreme Court right now has a case in front of it asking it to construe the meaning of the federal statute as affects a church whose application to build a building in a single-family zone in West Lynn was turned down. And the church says, you can't turn us down because we have a federal statute that says we can build our church here. And the Oregon Supreme Court, in order to answer that question, has to pretty much interpret federal law. And as you can well imagine, all of the circuits who have looked at that statute so far have come up with different answers. So what is a state court to do when the meaning of the federal law is not settled? But that's part of what makes this a dynamic system. So, all of the statutes that you pass that affect who can sue whom for what and what the jurisdiction of Oregon courts are have some spillover into the federal system, and this complicated federal system in turn spills over onto what the courts of Oregon are doing. Now, with that totally complicated picture of the judicial system, Brian is going to talk about the processes that courts have come up with for handling the cases, and then I'll talk about how we're using those processes in Oregon.
And as I said when I began, there'll be a question and answer period at the end, and that'll be right before the test.
Right before the quiz.
So, before I turn my attention to the processes, I want you to buy into something that we'll prove to you at the end of our remarks. Everything that Susan has been talking about is the smallest piece of the dispute resolution activity in our society. The things that I'll talk about are the largest, and I'll show you what I mean. I'm going to use the board.
Brian, if you could kind of cozy up to a microphone, that'd be great.
I'll certainly try. And to all of you, I apologize.
Yeah,
that seems
like
that's about as close.
That should do it.
What I'm going to draw is a continuum of dispute resolution. Okay? And I'm going to put four processes up on the board. But before I do that, I want you to accept these are the societally approved processes of dispute resolution, okay? The biggest one occurs over here to the left before we make the continuum, and this is abandonment. This is people who just walk away from whatever problem they encounter, okay? All this talk about our litigious society, as the statistics that Justice Leeson started to give you, don't hold up. The vast majority of things are things that people surrender. They just walk away from it. They don't want to get involved in whatever processes are available to them. At the other end, the far end, again, not on the continuum, is another segment of dispute resolution that I'm not going to deal with, and that's the self-help remedies. Okay?
Where I thought you were going to say murder.
Well, murder falls in that category. As does war, as does breaking someone's window and running, all those sorts of things fall into the self-help category, and or repossessing a car falls into the self-help category. So we're not talking about either of those. We're talking about those that are societally approved. And this is also a slight segment of a historical lesson. I'm going to give you the 1970s and then the 2000 version. In the 1970, at least as far as the official court system went, there were two processes that we would have to concern ourselves with. First, negotiation, and second, litigation. Negotiation, in its simplest form, negotiation looks like this. And simply involves trying to resolve it. Anyway, talking to people, trying to resolve it through some conversation. And if the Honorable Justice Leeson and I had an auto accident, and I said, look, here's what my damages are, and she said, well, I'd rather this didn't go to my insurance company, take it to whoever you want, give me a couple bids, and we can work this out, and we worked it out, that's fine. Okay? Simple, straightforward, parties resolving their conflicts themselves. It's the oldest process available to us, negotiation, a communication process. And then again in the 1970s, if we were unable to work it out, then we would fall back on that tried and true lawyer maxim, sue the bastards. And it would wind up in litigation. Litigation comes from the Latin. The Latin root word is litigare. It means to carry. In its simplest form, attorney-client, attorney-client, and the judge. It is a, now, someone might say, well, excuse me, you don't need an attorney to go to litigation. Technically, that's true. You don't probably need brakes on your car either. It would just be foolish to drive without them. And the same thing would be true about going into court. Court is, it is a system of the presentation of a case that relies upon rules of procedure that you structure, rules of evidence that you have impact over, and rules of ethical conduct that you again have control over, that if you are unfamiliar with, creates an entirely foreign language and makes it very difficult to prevail. The task in litigation is a very simple one. When the court convenes, the judge has at his or her disposal that board with nothing written on it. And the lawyer number one, the lawyer bringing the case, whether it be a prosecutor in a criminal case or a plaintiff's lawyer in a civil case, has the obligation of writing on that board enough factual material that the trier of fact could conclude that they should prevail. Okay? The law, you, establish three standards of proof and then assigns those standards of proof to different types of cases. The lowest standard of proof is a preponderance of the evidence. It simply means it's more likely than not. The next standard is called clear and convincing. Well, preponderance is used in most civil cases. Clear and convincing is used in specialized cases like child custody. What's in the best interest of the child? The evidence must be clear and convincing. And the last standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, and that standard is only used in criminal cases where someone's liberty is at stake. And so those three standards are assigned to different cases by legislators like you. And once they're assigned, then the lawyer knows his or her burden. And they put things on that board so the trier of fact can rely upon that evidence to make a conclusion. Unfortunately, it's not as simple as that. Because while they're trying to write on the board, the other attorney is trying to A, erase what's on the board, or B, prevent what's on the board from being considered with the weight the first attorney wanted it considered. So we have what's known in legal philosophy as a fight theory of justice. The two sides fight in front of the judge, and the truth emerges phoenix-like from the dust. Well, that's the theory. It doesn't always work exactly that way. What does happen is they do fight in front of the judge, and something emerges, and then this is where the concept of law comes in. The judge evaluates whether or not what has been presented satisfies the legal requirements as the statutes or case law outline them. So, for example, if it's a negligent case, there has to be sufficient evidence on four elements: that there was a duty, that there was a breach, that there was causation, that there was damages. And if the evidence fails on any one of those, the judge could throw it out. Even if there was a jury, it might not be allowed to reach the jury. If it's a criminal case, it depends what you've said is the requirements for a criminal case. In a burglary, you've outlined what the person would have to prove. The judge, again, would weigh the evidence for legal sufficiency even before a jury would be allowed to make a determination. So that's the way it works. It's a very simple, very straightforward, very complicated, very confusing system. Okay? And you set the rules. Now, that's where I said it was in the 70s. You either tried to work it out. If you couldn't work it out, you went to court. Or you went back and abandoned it. That happens all the time. The question is, what happened post then? Well, in the late 70s and into the 80s, the drug war became excessively serious. And that took most of the available docket space in the criminal cases. By docket space, I meant that if you had, for example, in Marion County, 8 courts, and most of those courts are engaged in prosecuting or trying cases of folks charged with drug offenses, then you don't have many courts available to hear the civil cases. So faced with this new complication of not having access to courts, people started looking for their alternatives. And the first alternative to gain prominence in the 80s was arbitration. Arbitration looks kind of like that. We've taken the case out of the formal setting of the courtroom. We've put it at a conference table. The judge is no longer dressed in robes. Now she's dressed in a business suit or business attire. And she's at one end of the table, and the attorney and client's on one side of the attorney. But it is still litigation in this sense. It's a submission method. The parties give it to the arbitrator to decide. Okay? And the arbitrator makes a decision. In almost all arbitrations, they are binding. That means that once that decision is rendered, that's it. There are some, and these are what are attached to the courts, and you have a court annex program here in Oregon. In those court annex arbitrations, the decision that is rendered is not binding. And you've also limited the amount of money that can be taken to arbitration. And soon we'll talk about both of those facts. Arbitration, although it's been around much longer, it's much older than litigation. Litigation is the baby here. Arbitration has been around since it's the last clause in George Washington's will. If a dispute arises, it's how Brazil speaks Portuguese and the rest of South America speaks Spanish. That was arbitrated. The American Arbitration Association was founded in 28. The Federal Arbitration Act was passed in 33. So it's been around for a long time, but it didn't gain currency. And by what I mean by currency is use in everyday dispute resolutions like it is now until the 80s. And in the 80s, it just exploded. And now it generated an entire industry of dispute resolution providers. You see them up in Portland and here in Salem. There's lots of folks who advertise themselves as arbitrators, mediators. It's a cottage industry. It's also a number of folks have tried to engage in it nationally and to some extent have been successful and to most extents have not. The difficulty there with arbitration, and there is one, is that if you engage in private arbitration and you say it's binding, then you lose your right to appeal. And that's everything that Justice Leeson was talking about. And so if there's an egregious error of law or if the person just didn't understand the facts, you've lost that. So a lot of people did not like that. And so we're about to turn our attention to the last of the processes. But before we do that, I want you to understand that arbitration has this private sense, but you still control the rules for it because it takes everything from litigation. It is the standards, the concepts, what constitutes proof, how much proof, all that is bleeds from litigation. So although you are not setting, you know, the rules for arbitration, you are influencing it. And we're seeing it so much more in our daily life that you ought to be influencing it more. For example, in all of your health insurance policies, there's an arbitration clause. And I'm going to wager pretty strongly that you didn't agree to it. If you download software, there's an arbitration clause. I'm going to wager pretty strongly that you probably didn't agree to it. And the interesting thing is, you know, where did you agree to have your case arbitrated when you downloaded Microsoft? Did you agree that you would fly to Delaware? And these are the kinds of things that happen in those sorts of cases, and so you might want to be a little more sensitive to it. The last process is the newest, if you will. It's the oldest after negotiation of what's up here, but it's the newest in currency, and that's mediation. Mediation in its simplest form looks like that. We've got three people on the table, around the table, but we've got a major distinction. The major distinction is that the mediator has no power to decide. That's the distinction. Okay? What the mediator has is the power to bring people together. For my law classes, I sometimes define it this way. Imagine a couple married 7 years, three children, things just haven't been going well. One of them moved out of the family home about 6 months ago. And so they make a deal that one of them, the grandparents are going to come over, take the kids out. The spouse who's been out of the family home is going to come back. They're going to sit down at the kitchen table and resolve their differences. And Monday, someone's going to file for divorce. So grandma comes over, takes the kids. The spouse who's been out of the home comes back. They sit down at the table. They start to kind of work through this. There's coffee on the table. There's legal pads. There's tension in the air. And finally, one says, "What would solve this for you?" And the other one looks, pauses, and says, "You could die." Well, what just happens? Off they go to hire two attorneys skilled in the Attila the Hun, rip the lips off the witness, school of trial advocacy, and they're in court, right? So let's take them out of their home with that unsuccessful negotiation, and we'll take them to a mediator's office on Saturday. Same tension, same legal pads, same cardboard box with receipts. They sit down, and one says to the other before the mediator can intervene, "What would solve this for you?" The other one fights it, loses control, and says, "You could die." Well, very quickly, the mediator would go, "That's one option." Turns to the other party, says, "What'll solve it for you?" Guess what they say? "That's two options." Then the mediator looks up and says, "What other options are there?" And they keep talking. And what had been the kind of thing that would be an emotional roadblock that would end the game becomes just an interesting story to tell at Senate Judiciary meetings. Okay? It doesn't end it. And they keep working. All right, let me draw some conclusions, and then I'll give it back to my colleague to tell you how this works in our world. Start over here from the left and start walking down, and you'll see that the parties are surrendering power as they move from left to right. They have their most power in negotiation. They talk about what they want to talk about. They talk when they want to talk. They talk to who they want to talk. And they have the power to decide what the outcome is. In mediation, they give away some of that process power. They select the mediator, then they encourage him or her to tell them what to talk about, how to order it, and even whether or not they'll be in the same room together, okay? But the parties still maintain control over the outcome. There's no deal unless the parties say there's a deal. In arbitration, they give away some of the process and keep some of the process. They get to select, for example, who the arbitrator is. They get to select what rules there are, etc. But once they've selected it, then the arbitrator controls. And the arbitrator sets a hearing, they have a hearing, and the arbitrator says, "This is what we will do." And in litigation, the parties have no control over rules, and they have no control over outcome. So what you've done is you have a dissolution of power as you go from left to right. That's one of the important observations. Here's the other one, and then I'll leave you to my colleague. The line I've just drawn between negotiation and mediation and arbitration and litigation is a crucial distinction. It's not simply the left-hand side is consensual, the right-hand side is adjudicative, although that is true as well. Here's the distinction. The left-hand side is forward-looking. The right-hand side is backward-looking. Let me tell you what I mean by that. In the right-hand side, litigation and arbitration, those processes depend for their answer about what to do next. They look for their answer to the past. they have an argument over a factual matter. There has to be a factual matter, or else they wouldn't be able to get it in court. They have an argument over a factual matter as to what happened, and they resolve that argument by getting a ruling from a judge or an arbitrator or a jury, and once they have that ruling, they know what happens next. Because now you just simply assign, it's formulaic. You assign rights and responsibilities based upon what happened in the past. On the left-hand side, negotiation and mediation, it's a forward-looking process. The mediator or the parties have to convince each other to embrace a certain future. They do not have to agree on the past. It's a very big distinction, and it takes a lot of skill to get people to do that, because we are a very rights-oriented society, and we like to have things. We like to know whose fault it was or how this transpired. And to the extent we chase fault, to that extent, we don't get a deal. I would give to you, for those watching on CCTV, the Salem-Keizer School District is about to encounter a strike because they're chasing the facts over what happened in the past rather than worrying about what's going to happen next. And it's just not in their best interest.
Good. This will go quickly. And if I don't, I can tell all the rest of you are going to escape too. All right, here we go. Ryan's continuing. Negotiation, mediation, arbitration, litigation. But I want to just get a brief overview as how are those processes being used in the courts of Oregon. I told you a few minutes ago that in 2003, we had approximately 656,000 cases filed in Oregon in the courts. If every one of those cases went to trial, the system would be on its knees. With respect to how many of those cases are appealed, the Court of Appeals in 2003 heard about 3,300 cases, and the Oregon Supreme Court heard about 100 cases. Now, their function, this is a law announcing court. Its function is different from the Court of Appeals, which is an error correcting court. And these trial courts are fact-finding and law application courts. What I find remarkable is how we get from this number, 656,000, and as Brian pointed out, there's a whole lot going on that never winds up in court, to 3,300 and then to 100. And the answer is that all of these courts are using these various processes in much more creative ways than they were even 15 years ago. Some examples. Of these 656,000 cases, we know that some are criminal. In fact, we know that the overwhelming number are criminal, and that many are civil. How many criminal cases actually wind up going to trial? Well under 3%. Because a process of negotiation, it's called plea bargaining, which we've all heard about, winds up resolving most of those cases so that they are never litigated. Okay. Criminal cases fall in the category of felonies and misdemeanors, and some are committed by adults and some are committed by juveniles. The juvenile justice system has come up with very creative ways for resolving a number of conflicts. I'm a volunteer mediator, for example, in victim offender programs. Cases that the juvenile courts either think cannot be prosecuted successfully or should not be prosecuted because it would be better for the victim to sit down with the offender and let the victim have a direct say in the restitution and the resolution of the case, are referred out to us volunteers, and we take care of thousands of cases a year that drop out of the system that way. In other words, mediation is being used in some first offender juvenile, primarily property crimes cases, to help decrease that number. But the most criminal cases are resolved through negotiation. With respect to civil cases, as Brian pointed out, by statute, Oregon now has court-annexed, is what they're called, court-annexed arbitration statutes. The statutes presently say that the county court can decide case is $25,000 or $50,000, they get to choose what their upward number is, automatically go to arbitration, with the right of the losing party to bring the case into court to litigate. But most of the cases that are referred to court annex arbitration are resolved, and the parties give it up. They let it go. In this broad category of cases, we also have domestic relations that we talked about. Most of the domestic relations cases now have mandatory mediation associated with them. Now, if there has been spousal abuse or child abuse, those cases clearly don't qualify. But for issues of custody and dissolution and property settlements and so on, those cases are being referred. Many judges are using a process that is somewhere between negotiation and mediation called settlement conferences. You've probably heard judges have different reputations. There are some who have the reputation of how far can you put your arm behind your back if it hurts? Let me hold it a little tighter, and we'll get a number out of you, and we'll get this case settled. Other judges see themselves as acting really as an intermediary between the parties for them to find their own resolution. But virtually every judge in this state is engaging in settlement conferences for civil cases. So lots of use of the various processes. We started a mediation program at the Court of Appeals in 1995. For civil cases on appeal, are now successfully resolving more than 100 of those. While I was at the Supreme Court, we successfully used the mediation program a couple of times to resolve a lawyer discipline case and a child custody case. So these processes are increasingly available and are letting the courts deal more expeditiously with the wide range of disputes that are being presented to them. I'm done.
We'd be glad to take any questions. In summary, you sit at the tip of the pyramid. The rest of the system, which is dynamic and huge, works because rules are announced and then courts are enforce and apply those rules. So it's a very hand-in-glove sort of operation, and you have control over it.
The way you present it here, if you get to the point of litigation, in a sense, it's a failure. It's a failure of the other processes to work. In your experience, what are the main causes of that failure?
Overconfidence. there's a study out of Arizona that says that about the cases that go to trial, it was something like 88% of the cases that go to trial, both people anticipate winning. And that suggests that someone is, you know, because only one of those people is going to be correct. So I think overconfidence is the single largest. And in some jurisdictions, and this is another difficulty you have, you know, we have different standards. Some prosecutors take in criminal cases, one view in Multnomah County, for example, that may not be the view in Baker County. And so that too influences whether or not someone can resolve a case.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, when you say, I guess I need to know how you define overconfidence. What I have seen with the public is it's become very polarized. The public believes everyone's staked out their position and said, I'm right and you're wrong. There's not much gray area. So I wouldn't characterize that as overconfidence more than just someone being very stubborn and very rigid in their belief system. And I've just seen our society creep that way. Would you say that that's adding to the problem as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I agree, but I would keep in mind that, as my associate has pointed out, we provide information to people all along the way now. So they've probably had someone come in and say to them, you know, you are mistaken. The odds of you prevailing in this case are not as good as you think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not a there's a publication called Jury Verdicts Northwest that will tell people what other cases similarly situated to theirs have gotten. There's experienced judges and arbitrators who will, in a court annex situation, will render an advisory opinion and say, you know, this case is probably worth X, Y, or Z. That doesn't occur, and I'll give you an area where you might want want to evaluate whether it should occur. Medical malpractice is, as you know, a hot button. Many jurisdictions have incorporated panels that evaluate those cases before they're allowed to be filed. And the parties have to be advised as to the panel's conclusion as to both the validity of claim and the value of claim.
Madam Chair, I think California is doing that, if I read my stuff correctly about that. The other issue is that, you know, when people take it all the way to the end, as Justice Leeson said, they end up mad at somebody. They're mad at their lawyer, or they're mad at that crazy judge who just didn't apply the law correctly, and that's really unfortunate, because, you know, the legal system is here to help people, but so often they see it as an adversary.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, in that sense, the litigation system hasn't changed in the past 400 years. Voltaire wrote that I was a ruined man, but twice, once when I lost the lawsuit and once when I won.
Very good. Thank you.
I found that one of the concepts that's especially helpful in your presentation is there's a dividing line that when you talk about negotiation and mediation, you're looking forward. And when you're looking at arbitration and litigation, you're looking back to try to assign blame. That really kind of speaks to me. But Justice Gleeson, I wanted to ask you, I thought I heard you say that in some cases with arbitration, although the decision of the arbitrator is final, is it sometimes appealable? Maybe I misunderstood that.
Well, Senator Burdick, in Oregon, by statute, in the court annexed context where the judge assigns the case out for arbitration because it falls within that jurisdictional limit of $25,000 or $50,000, mm-hmm. the dissatisfied party can appeal for what's called a trial de novo in the circuit court.
Ah.
Now, there are risks associated with that in terms of money, but the right to appeal for a trial de novo and then go to the Court of Appeals and to the Supreme Court remains. In the private arbitration system, and there really is a parallel private system of justice developing in this country, the American Arbitration Association has binding arbitration, for example. There's no appeal there.
And that's used a lot in labor disputes?
It's used a lot in labor disputes and a lot in commercial disputes. We're seeing fewer and fewer commercial disputes in our public litigation system because the parties can't wait. I'm working on a case at the Court of Appeals right now that was filed 6 years ago.
Mm.
And a lot of it was the party's delay. But if you're trying to run a business, you can't wait 6 years to get your case tried and then take it on appeal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A final question for me is if you could give us any advice on what we might do as a committee or as a legislature to kind of direct people toward the negotiation and mediation. Is there anything that comes to your mind from a policy sense that you would recommend?
Senator Burdick, thank you for asking, because I'm one who would happily lobby you to support the community dispute resolution programs. I think it's amazing what private citizens are doing to help keep justice in front of the parties, with victims having the say over what the appropriate resolution is and holding offenders directly accountable. I worked with a young man one day who said, I lied to my parents, to the police, to my lawyer, to the judge, but I can't lie to the victim because he knows what I did to his house. I think that's pretty powerful.
Well, this committee, just so you know, is a big fan club of the community.
That's wonderful to hear. I think other processes, a number of people have talked about raising the jurisdictional limitations for court-annexed arbitration, thinking that perhaps larger civil cases should be referred out. Helping to create the culture that we just keep talking, I think, is so important in moving towards dispute resolution. Because back to Senator Walker's really fine question, I think we only learn to bridge our differences when we keep talking.
Mm-hmm.
And any incentives we can have to find common ground, I think, are really important in this process. So I've never known anybody who's won a lawsuit who came away happy. That quote from Voltaire is wonderful. But I've never known anybody who won who said, hey, That was really great. Everybody comes out of litigation still mad.
That's very interesting. Maybe we should require mandatory service in the legislature, because some of these things that you're talking about are certainly survival skills around here. Are there any other questions or comments? Thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate your coming.
Thank you for your time.
This for us. Okay, we will close the informational meeting and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 337. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Senate Bill 337 would create the civil cause of action of wrongful sterilization. The measure provides for damages, including punitive damages, and also provides for reasonable attorney fees and costs to the prevailing party.
Okay, we have signed up on this one. We'll start off with Bob Jundeth to present this bill. I believe it's your bill. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeth. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. I'm here today primarily in our role under ORS 436-335. As you know, Oregon has a piece of legislation governing sterilizations of people who are unable to consent to sterilization. That law was enacted in 1983, and part of that statute requires Oregon Advocacy Center to be informed of all civil processes that are undertaken to determine whether a person has capacity or not to consent to sterilization, and if not, to determine whether sterilization should go forward or not.
Mr. Jundeth, could you speak up just a little bit? I see people back in the room craning their necks here. Thank you.
Over on the House side, you're supposed to step back from the microphone. So we're here in my role as the director of the Advocacy Center to report to you about how that law is being implemented during the year. We generally receive very few notifications of sterilization procedures, usually no more than three a year, sometimes none. Occasionally we will receive a complaint that a sterilization has been performed outside of that procedure, although there's no necessity that we're informed of that, but sometimes it happens. In September of 2003, in September of 2003, we received a complaint from staff member at a group home for developmentally disabled adults operated by the Albertina Kerr Association, reporting that a young man living in that facility had been taken for a doctor's appointment by a family member who indicated that they were taking the young man out for a hernia check. When they returned to the group home, they were informed that he had just had a vasectomy, and they left some follow-up care instructions for the group home. They were shocked by that revelation and called our office to complain about the situation. We investigated the situation and learned that the underlying facts were true. The question then was what remedy was available to that young man at that point. This is a young man who has a legal guardian. Of course, guardians under Oregon law are prohibited from consenting to sterilization. The statutory framework of the sterilization law is the one way that a person can use to achieve a non-consensual sterilization. So the guardian didn't have authority, but apparently what we learned is that a physician had acted under what the physician believed was the authority of the guardian to direct the sterilization. So we looked at various options that one could pursue as a remedy. I don't profess to have an encyclopedic understanding of the area, but one option, of course, would be a criminal prosecution for battery, because if you touch a person without their consent or appropriate legal consent, that would be a crime. we thought that that might be going a little too far, but certainly, and it would be difficult to get a district attorney to look at a case like that. Another option would be a civil action for battery or potentially for malpractice for the action. But we found in a situation like this that that was extremely unlikely. First of all, the victim of the sterilization was a very disabled individual who didn't have the ability either to consent to a sterilization or, frankly, to a legal process. And the guardian in the matter had, in fact, been part of the one of the people who brought the sterilization about. And secondly, moving into a relationship where even we or anyone else were to walk in and disrupt that guardianship relationship, which might have been sound on other grounds, seemed to us to be highly disruptive. The second problem with taking that route is that of course, as you know, in a civil action, generally speaking, a person has to have the ability either to pay an attorney for their time or the attorney has to take that case on a contingency basis. In a case of the sterilization of a young man with severe disabilities, pinpointing damages in a case like that, and those damages amounting to a large enough amount that would allow, give an attorney an incentive to take the case, get a contingency fee, and proceed with it, seemed highly unlikely. So the last option was to make a complaint to the Board of Bar Examiners, perhaps to seek some sort of discipline by the Board of Medical Examiners on this matter. We looked at that statute, and it was unclear as to whether that covered the matter or not, although we did pursue a complaint. We were, of course, unable to determine what the outcome of that complaint was because that's confidential. So we were stymied, and we thought, well, what could create a reasonable incentive to follow the law such that there was some potential repercussions for violating it? What we looked to was a section of our state law that governs state medical records and psychiatric records. That's 179.505 ORS. That body of law provides certain rights of confidentiality for people who receive state medical services, and it says that if that right is violated, if someone were to reveal their state medical or psychiatric records, that that person may bring an action, specific action for damages. There's minimum damages, and there's an opportunity for attorney's fees and costs should there be a prevailing, to the prevailing party. In other words, this creates the possibility that a person, a state hospital patient, someone who would have very difficult time really pinpointing damages for release of certain information, has an opportunity to seek a remedy. There's a way to pay for an attorney to be paid for doing it, and that person can receive satisfaction for the harm that's been done to them. That's the model that we chose as a manner in which a person could enforce the right under state law. The second thing we did in this bill is that we added to the long list of items that a physician may be disciplined for doing an illegal sterilization. As you can tell, there is already a very long list. I've been told subsequently by the Board of Medical Examiners that they feel they have the authority to discipline a doctor under a general standard of unprofessional conduct. Our concern and feeling was that by putting it in the long list, and that list, I assume, also contains many things that would constitute unprofessional conduct, that would bring to the attention of physicians, if they weren't aware of it already, that in fact there is a sterilization law, that they have certain obligations under that sterilization law, and would constitute fair notice. And so that's the thinking that went into the bill that we brought to you today for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? We have one other proponent of this bill signed up, Bob Castagna, and maybe we'll just take you and then we'll move into the other side here. Why don't you stay there, Mr. Junda? Great. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Robert J. Castagna, General Counsel and Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. For the record, the Oregon Catholic Conference is the public policy office representing the Catholic bishops of Oregon in service to Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 Oregonians, and we do this effort in pursuit of the common good for all Oregonians. Now, the Oregon Advocacy Center presented us this bill and asked us to take a look at it to see whether or not it was an issue that raised the moral component or dimension as public policy and that we might take a position on. We have done that. I've reviewed it with a board member, and we have decided to support this legislation because we think it will enhance, in the public's eyes and in the law, the plight of those who are disabled or mentally challenged in an area of the law where they may not be protected. We organize our public policy positions on a consistent ethic of life basis, with the dignity of the person and the sanctity of human life being the key value from conception until natural death and everywhere in between. And if there are a class of people who are being afforded less than their full human rights because of their human condition, we think the law should fully protect them. And it's in that light that we urge the adoption of Senate Bill 337.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We will now hear from Andy Easton from the Oregon Medical Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Andy Easton, Associate Director of the Oregon Medical Association. The OMA represents approximately 7,200 physicians throughout the state. I come to you today before the committee and ask that you oppose this bill. The OMA and its members believe that there are safeguards already in place in Oregon law that adequately protect patients from wrongful sterilizations. In those rare cases, when a person is wrongfully sterilized, the injured party has an avenue for legal redress, such as claims for medical malpractice and torturous battery. Further performing the procedure without informed consent may constitute unprofessional conduct. The Oregon Medical the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners, the BME, can impose disciplinary sanctions up to and including revocation of licensure. Under current law, physicians owe a statutory duty to care to patients and are required to obtain an informed consent of the patient. Therefore, a physician who fails to follow standard of care or to obtain informed consent when required is exposed to liability. It is in the opinion of the OMA that claims available to an injured patient under current law provide adequate deterrence to physicians in order to protect the public from harm. When a physician has reason to believe that the patient is incapable of giving informed consent, then the physician cannot perform the sterilization procedure without a court order. A natural parent, legal guardian, cannot give substitute consent for sterilization. A petition to the court to determine sterilization can be asked by the individual seeking the procedure, a parent, a guardian, or the physician themselves. In making the determination, the court must rule on whether the person has the ability to give informed consent. If the person has such ability and the request for the procedure, then the court shall order permitting the procedure. On the other hand, if the person does not consent to the procedure, then the court shall issue an order forbidding the procedure. If the court determines that the person is not able to give informed consent, it is the responsibility of the court to determine whether sterilization is in the best interest of that individual. As previously noted, a person who is subject to sterilization procedure without informed consent has a base to allege claims for for professional negligence and battery. In addition, a physician who performs the procedure without obtaining informed consent is subject to enforcement by the VMA. This bill does, however, create a statutory cause of action for wrongful sterilization and imposes minimum compensatory damages of up to $10,000. Under current law, if a physician reasonably believes that the patient is incapable of giving informed consent, then the physician cannot perform the sterilization procedure without a court order. The importance of reasonable belief determination would accordingly increase in significance under Senate Bill 337 and may discourage providers of performing such procedures without a court order. ALMA believes that current law represents an appropriate balance of interest by imposing significant restrictions on the ability of a provider to perform sterilization procedures, while at the same time allowing providers to perform such procedures based on professional medical judgment. Any damages that are proven at trial are available to a plaintiff injured, and as a result of the failure to obtain informed consent, and thus the mandatory minimum award is unnecessary.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
No, I was going to address some questions to Ms. Easton about some of the conclusions she reaches, but I've received a note from you that we'll have a witness behind you that will answer those questions more appropriately. Thank you.
You're trying to build the suspense, Senator Walker.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, next we have Kathleen Haley from the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. And while you're coming to the podium, I would like to inform the audience and the committee that we will be entering a letter in the record on behalf of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition, signed by Catherine White, who wanted to speak in favor of this bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. The board is an 11-member board that has general supervision over the practice of medicine in the state. And the board takes no position on Senate Bill 337, but would like to bring to your attention that the board already has the authority under ORS 677190 to take discipline for a sterilization that is not performed according to the law, and that is the unprofessional conduct sanction is available to the board currently for a physician who engages in that behavior. I've set forth for you in my testimony a little bit of the language on ORS 677190 as it's defined in 677188. I'd like to address one of the things that Mr. Joondev said, and that is that a complainant to the board does not have the right to find out what happened. And someone who does complain to the board does receive notification of the outcome of the board's decision-making, and in addition is able to get more underlying information than would someone in the general public. So I wanted to clarify that point for you. In addition, the board has attached to your testimony a copy of an article that the board put in its spring 2004 newsletter on this issue, which was written by Mr. Joondef, in an effort to engage in our ongoing education of physicians about this issue. In the 10 years that I have been with the board, we have had two cases checked with staff today, and there have been two cases of this type of sterilization where the appropriate consent through the courts was not obtained. One other issue about the bill that I want to bring to your attention is this is one that was brought by our Assistant Attorney General, and that is the language that says that are medically indicated, and in any kind of sterilization and any kind of medical procedure, there really needs to be informed consent. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention for a potential clarification there. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Mm-hmm. Now, Senator Walker?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Haley, how did the board discipline the doctors in the two cases in the last 10 years? I'm sure you can at least tell me generally.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, there was no discipline after after the investigations were complete.
Well, Madam Chair, that requires a follow-up, if I might. Okay, there was no discipline after the investigation was complete, so I'm left to assume two outcomes. I mean, two results of the investigation. One, the sterilization did not take place without informed consent, or two, the sterilization did not take place. I mean, how could you not sanction a physician for doing something without consent?
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, actually there's a third option, and that is, it's not a public document, but it is a third option, and that is a letter of concern to the physician after all the investigation is complete to say that the physician needs to be aware of this statute and needs to follow the directives there and go to court before any kind of sterilization takes place.
Well, Madam Chair, one more follow-up.
One more.
That shocks me, actually. So what the redress available to the victim then would be within the court system because you sent a letter to the doctor and that was about it, correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, the victim would have redress through the court system. The board's supervision is over physicians in the state and takes disciplinary action after a thorough investigation of all the facts in a case. And there can be mitigating facts which would allow the board to send a letter of concern rather than discipline the physician.
Okay, I'm going to cogitate on that for a while. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Pazanski.
Regarding the two cases that you brought to us, do you know what, if any, relief those two complainants received through the court system or any other process?
Madam Chair, Senator Pazanski, I'm not aware of that, but I could go back to the office and check and see if we have that information available.
I'm going to follow up on that. I'm assuming you would have that information during a thorough investigation. If there was something, there should be something in your files.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, we're usually aware if there is some type of malpractice action that's engaged in it pursuant to the same set of facts. So I will get back to you with that.
Okay, one other question. Does that, if there was some type of relief that was given to one of these complainants through another process, does that in fact have a bearing as to the decision of the Board of Medical Examiners as to whether or not a physician should or shouldn't be sanctioned based on unprofessional conduct?
Chair Burdick, Senator Pazanski, that's an excellent question, particularly in this environment. That does not have an influence. The only influence it has is actually all the malpractice cases do come to the board's attention, so it gives them one more mechanism in which to review a case.
Thank you.
I guess that kind of brings up a follow-up on my part. Have you seen, you said you only had two cases, so I assume you're not seeing, they aren't both the same physician.
Chair Burdick, no, if that was the case, I'm not the board and I don't make the decisions, but I can almost assure you that there would be a different outcome if there was more than one case against one physician.
Does it go into your decision-making on whether to issue a letter of concern rather than a disciplinary action? I mean, is the kind of the level of intent of the physician, is that a factor in that decision making process?
Chair Burdick, that's one piece of the puzzle. The board really looks at the totality of the circumstances. They would look at the malpractice history of that physician, they would look at the background of that physician, whether there were other complaints of any nature against that physician, what the physician's response to that was, potentially an interview with the alleged victim. I mean, there's a realm of investigation that takes place before the board comes to its decision. And the board is comprised of 11 members, 9 physicians, 2 public members, and no case is closed without the full board review.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, did you have a question?
Questions asked and answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 337 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 248. Mr. Junedeff, you're back on again. And let's see, we have actually three people speaking on behalf of this. Why don't you all come up, Tina Kitchen and Bob Castagna. Counsel, would you please summarize?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 248 is a guardianship statute. It would amend the guardianship statute to clarify that a legal guardian of an incapacitated person may only withhold tube feeding of a protected person in limited circumstances.
Welcome to the committee again.
Chair, for the record, my name is Bob Junedeff, Director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. And Senate Bill 248 is, again, a product of experience, just like the bill you just heard, in that we receive from time to time complaints having to do with end-of-life decision-making for people with severe disabilities. In the past 2 years, we have had three separate cases that have involved situations in which there was an individual who had a serious disability, had been disabled all their lives, in fact, born with severe disabilities, and had relied upon tube feeding for a good portion of their life, or had more recently had to use tube feeding in order to sustain them. And we were alerted, usually this comes again from a provider of services in the community in the developmental disabilities world. The complaint came to us about decisions by a guardian to consent to withdrawal of tube feeding for those individuals.
Okay, Mr. Junedeff, could you speak up just a little bit? Appreciate it. Thank you.
In consulting the statutes governing this area, we found that the Oregon legislature had done an enormous amount of work on the topic of withdrawal of tube feeding back in the 93 session, and had basically built into the statute a presumption that a person consents to have artificial feeding, but there were some exceptions built in, and those exceptions were primarily situations in which a person had indicated in an advance directive that they didn't want that, or they were in a terminal state, either within 6 months of death, permanently unconscious, having late stage Alzheimer's, or providing that feeding would create great pain to the extent that there was a feeling that it caused more harm than good. My own experience being a graybeard here, as you can see, is that I did work with the legislature at that time, and in fact I worked the following session on a work group that rewrote our guardianship statutes. When we rewrote our guardianship statutes, we tied the concept of medical decision making from the guardianship statute over to the advanced directive end of life situation decision making. Upon revisiting the statute in light of the cases that we saw, what we found was that guardians somehow, through the interaction of these two bodies of law, the guardians now had, in fact, carte blanche to consent to withdrawal of artificial nutrition and hydration in any situation, and in fact received protection from liability for making that decision. At least that is one interpretation of those statutes, and one that some elder law practitioners have forwarded. I can tell you personally, having worked on both of these, that was never an intent, certainly of the guardianship revision. I spoke with Senator Shoemaker, who had chaired both of those efforts, and
asked him if, when we worked on the guardianship statute, if he had intended that we create such a carte blanche for a guardian, and he said that he could never recall having had that discussion, and at least he would not have gone down that road, and I personally believe that no one would have gone down that road. So what we're trying to do here is just to clarify that a guardian who's making medical decisions for their protected person is in the same situation as any other surrogate medical decision maker under the law. And this really brings a guardian into conformance with the Advanced Directive Medical Decision Making statute. As the bill is written, there was some question as to whether a guardian would be able to obtain the authority to make such a decision if a person was not in an end-of-life, 6 months within the end-of-life type of situation. Our feeling was that if a guardian could walk into court and prove to a judge that doing so was in the person's best interest for some circumstances that we can't contemplate, then that might be appropriate. In following that up, we asked that an amendment be prepared that would, if the committee wanted to go down that road, would specify that a guardian could take such an action, even if it wasn't an end-of-life circumstance, if the guardian was able to prove to a court that that taking an action was in the protected person's best interest. I would also like to raise for you the question of that if this committee were to entertain such an amendment, it might also wish to add a clear and convincing evidence standard to such a finding, since we are in fact talking about life and death here, and having a clear showing would be appropriate.
So what you're suggesting is that if there is any other circumstance aside from the last 6 months of life, that you would want a judge to have to be in on that, and the standard to be clear and convincing.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, so I understand that. Thank you. Continue. Are you done?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. You can go next. Ms. Kitchen.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tina Kitchen. I am the physician and medical director for the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. I've had the unfortunate circumstances to also have been notified in a lot of those same situations. And through our responsibility in the funding, the licensing, the regulating of those situations, those settings where these questions may arise, and through our requirements under statute around abuse investigations and neglect investigations, have been involved in those situations, and was actually also one of the people who participated in 1991 and 93 when the legislature finally passed the Oregon Healthcare Decisions Act, and was very clear that under the presumption of artificial nutrition and hydration, or a feeding tube, that the person themselves had the right. They could appoint somebody and give them the right, and then there were the four situations where the presumption could be overcome, and it's not just terminalizing last 6 months, it's permanently comatose, similar to what's happening in Florida. It is end-stage Alzheimer's-like condition, so that as somebody has dementia and is getting close to their end, where it's not medically appropriate at that point to use a feeding tube, or when the feeding tube itself would cause interminable pain, or suffering. So it was very clear coming out of that session that those were the people who had the authority, and I was very surprised to find that subsequent guardianship changes in the law had called that process into question. And so we are here supporting and urging you to support this bill.
And did you have a comment on the kind of a concept for an amendment that Mr. Judith mentioned?
I have seen the proposal to legislative Village Council on the concept for an amendment, and we believe we could support it. I think that that's a step beyond what was anticipated in 1993 as having another mechanism. But being a physician, I know that there are very unusual and unique circumstances that happen, and it's really difficult to make a law that will apply to everything all the time. So we could support it.
Thank you. Mr. Elk, questions from the committee? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Castagna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference, here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 248 as printed. The Oregon Catholic Conference was involved during the 80s and 90s during the legislative development of advance directives, powers of attorney for health care, the combined advance directive, and we were involved in the writing of the legislation to establish a statutory presumption in favor of the administration of nutrition and hydration. To see that statutory language, which was developed for the advance directive, be inserted and be able to apply in a guardianship situation, we believe is a good use of that statutory language. My testimony, however, in support of Senate Bill 248 is limited to the provisions of the printed bill. I have not had an opportunity to review any proposed amendment that would extend a guardian's ability to go into court and independently seek judicial authorization to remove the nutrition and hydration from a protected person. That type of amendment may cause us to reconsider our position on the bill.
Okay. We actually do have a copy, and it's not my intention to move this bill today, but if you could locate the, we can provide you a copy of the amendment and you can take a look at it, and we'd be interested to know what you think when you see it. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 248. And are there any other comments for the good of the order from the committee? Senator Pazansky, when is your Commerce Committee your out-of-towner, is that next week?
No, it's March 10th.
March, oh, not till then? Oh, never mind. I was just thinking about that today, and since we're all, most of us, members of the Commerce Committee, I think I'd bring that up. Okay, if there's no other further business, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Joe, let's schedule the work group on the exemption.